I'm Lisa B. Thompson.
And I'm Richard J. Reddick.
And this is season 3 of
Black Austin Matters.
In the studio today, we have Texas Poet Laureate Amanda Johnston.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here.
So I first found out about the amazing Amanda Johnston when she reached out to me about publishing something of mine for Torch Literary. And I'm like, here is this sister doing stuff for Black women, whatever you want, and don't pay me. Because I want to support you. I had no idea. I was talking to royalty and found out later, and just been really, just every time we see each other, engage with each other, I just get so inspired. And I also feel a sense of sisterhood that sometimes is missing. And it's nice to feel like we're in this together as opposed to, you know, Battlestar Galactica. She's just a beautiful spirit, and I can't wait to chat with her today.
So, Amanda, I want to start, and I'm just going to make a real quick point to everybody listening that we have this recurring theme on this show that we have Johnston High students here. So the pride of East Side,
oh, yeah.
Amanda Johnston, who went to Johnston High School, which I love, the Liberal Arts Academy specifically. But you were born in East St. Louis, but you came here fairly quickly. So your family made a shift down here, and you were in Maine for a while, get your MFA. So how did you end up in Texas? Because St. Louis to Texas is not always like the most obvious move. What was that move about?
Phone company. My mama worked for Ma Bell, they called back in the day.
Yes.
Yeah. Which eventually became AT&T. So, yeah, she transferred for work. And I was but 3 years old, 81, and moved down to Austin and stayed here. I was raised here in Austin, went to school here in Austin, but all my family was still there. So I still very much felt connected to East St. Louis, and would go back, you know, as it would be the reverse, go down south, you know, from further up north. I would go up south to East St. Louis to see my grandparents, my dad, my sister's family.
And what kept you, did you all stay here from that point on, or was it just a choice to stay in Austin, or was work keeping y'all here?
Austin was a great place for my mother and me at the time, you know, single mom. Mm-hmm. She had a good job, benefits with the phone company.
Yes.
You know, that was not something to sneeze at, that she could take care of me. And then 10 years later, my brother came along. So, you know, a single mom with two kids. And Austin was just really growing, but especially with the phone company, like diverse place to be, you know. So, you know, us being a biracial household, you know, my mother is white, my father is Black, my brother is Latino, his father is Latino. So we had a very mixed race in household. And, you know, being in Austin, there was something for all of us to be here. I also had other family here, which made it even more home for me. So my shout out to the Robinsons and Walkers.
There you go.
Yes. So do you consider yourself a native Austinite? There's a whole lot of conversation about that in the city with the gentrification and everything. Right. So, you know, this idea of authentic, native and all that.
I've been here my whole life, right? From 3 years old. So I won't say I'm a native because I wasn't born here, but my roots are so deep, I don't know a here without me and my family.
Well answered.
Yes. Yeah. Let them know.
I'll make the definitive declaration that being an Austinite means you went to high school here, and you did that. So, hey.
Oh, yeah.
So I did that. So that's my
claim. Preschool through high school.
Dealing with geography again, though, I understand that you consider yourself a Appalachian poet.
Mm-hmm.
And I know a lot of people know what Appalachia is, but few people know about Appalachia. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, so my husband was a sergeant in the Army, and that was the first time I left Austin was in 2000 when he was stationed at Fort Knox in Kentucky. So we moved to Kentucky, and while I was there, that's where I always say I started writing poetry seriously, mm-hmm. as just the transition to a very different place. Fort Knox, Kentucky, from Austin, Texas,
right.
was a bit of a culture shock, just different. And I had never lived on a military base before. Right. So I started writing poetry to just help myself. It was therapeutic, you know. And in doing that, though, I met other poets in Kentucky. For the longest, I really thought I was the only Black person writing poetry in Kentucky. And then I met Frank X. Walker,
wow.
and Nikki Finney and Crystal wow. Wilkinson, the founders of the Afro-Latian Poets. And that term comes from Frank X. Walker coined that term. He was born in Kentucky, but saw a definition of Appalachia that said white people from mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. Appalachian region.
Right.
And he was like, I was born in Danville. Mm-hmm. So I'm not Appalachian.
Right.
So he changed those P's to F's to make it Afro-Latian. And in doing so, he made a home for all of us who didn't fit that very restricting definition.
I love it.
That's fantastic. So Appalachia is getting a lot of attention right now.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder why.
Yes.
Yes.
We won't talk about that.
Yeah. But it tends to be framed.
I'm Billy with the bad book.
to that point, it tends to be framed yes. from a white normative perspective. And you call yourself Afro-Latian. And you write in Kentucky. And I actually went down a rabbit hole and did some research. Nikki Giovanni, Skip Gates, mm-hmm. Carter G. Woodson. So much yes. Black talent coming out of that region.
Bell Hooks.
Bell mm-hmm. Hooks, most definitely. So talk about the communities in that region. And what should folks know about Afro-Latia since we're talking about Appalachia a lot?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, if you know history and you know how this country was founded, then you know Black people have been here. Everywhere, 1619, right? Black mm-hmm. people have been nice. Here. So wherever, you know, the land meets the sky, mm. we've built a home.
Mm. We've
made...
That's a poet speaking.
Yep.
Where the land meets the sky, we make a home. Come on now.
Yep.
Out of grit, out of love, out of care, because we can, because we have to. Mm-hmm. Because tomorrow is not promised and today is beautiful if we got each other. That's where we are. So it's not surprising that in Appalachia, you know, mm-hmm. exists, that Appalachia includes Black people. You go to the Appalachian region and you're going to find, I'm sorry, if you find soul food, mm. you find, you know, us, you find the inventors. The creators, the culinary geniuses, right?
Come on now.
Who created this cuisine that has now been just called Southern.
Ooh, come on.
Right? And it doesn't stop there. You know, poetry was in the pulpit.
Yes.
Poetry mm. is in your neighbor's porch. Mm. The creators and the artists mm-hmm. and the cultivators that would never name that and didn't get credit for that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That was just home. So when we moved there, you know, I say from Midwest down to South and then back up into Kentucky, it was a natural fit for me to find my roots in this home that Frank, Crystal, Nikki all created for me. And as soon as I met them, they just said, "Welcome home. You belong." As a matter of fact, the first time I met Frank X. Walker was at a reading, and it was beautiful. I was just on the edge of my seat. Obviously, I was like, "Black man, Kentucky, you're writing poetry. This is amazing." Frank X. Walker is also the first Black person to be poet laureate of Kentucky, and then after him was Crystal Wilkinson.
Nice.
So Afro-Latian, just keep on doing it.
Wow.
But I was at a reading, and I was just mesmerized by his work and his presence, and I felt so validated. Right, seeing another Black person doing this incredible work. And a woman I had been writing with in this small writing community in Elizabethtown, she embarrassed me. She had a stack of my poems, and as I was about to get my book signed by him, she thrust my poems in his face and was like, "Look at her work, she's really good, she's really good."
Nice.
But then she said, this well-intended white woman said, "She would be even better if she didn't pigeonhole herself as a Black woman."
Ooh, ooh, ooh.
And I turned all shades of red, one hide, like, how fast can I get out of this room?
Right.
And Frank just looked at her and looked at me, and he signaled to the person selling the books to give me my money back, and he signed my book, You Belong to Us.
Oh.
And it was over from then. I said, yes, I do. This is my family now. So Kentucky will always be my poetry home. That's where I truly started writing with intention.
In a remarkable community.
Yes.
Yeah. Just to find all those people to sort of support you. You said something that we love in this podcast, which is you talked about food. So what's an Appalachian dish that we should be thinking about?
Oh, my gosh. I got to big up my sis, Crystal Wilkinson's new book. She'll tell you it's not a cookbook.
Yes.
But Pray Song for the Kitchen Ghost incredible stories. It's part memoir, but it also has these incredible recipes from five generations of Appalachians, of Black Appalachian people, her family. Incredible things in there, but it's our biscuits. I said everybody first start making them biscuits. You can't go wrong.
Moment of silence for the biscuits.
Biscuits from scratch, I'm saying. And then quickly after that, chicken and dumplings.
Yes.
I'll have two plates.
Oh my goodness. I should have had lunch before we got here.
I want to have for lunch now.
So good.
So I want to sing your praises. You are the Texas Poet Laureate. Congratulations. Yes.
Thank you.
Amanda Johnston. You're also the first Black woman to serve as Poet Laureate of Texas. So that's a big thing. And also this week we found out some other good news. You received from the Academy of American Poets Laureate Fellows a $50,000 grant to work on the impactful programming that you do. Talk to me about that new honor from the Mellon Foundation.
Thank you. Yes, I've been holding that close to the chest until they said we could say, but I'm so honored serving as Texas's Poet Laureate and specifically being the first Black woman to hold the title means so much to me. It's an honor. But if anything, I just want, again, like I mentioned with the Appalachians and Frank making me feel seen and validated, I want other Black women and BIPOC people to see themselves as a Texas Poet Laureate and to see themselves accomplishing whatever your dream is, that is possible, right? Just keep doing your work, show up, say the things you want out loud so that the people who do support you can help you on that path. They don't know if you don't say. And the same with this grant. I'm so grateful for the Academy of American Poets and the Mellon Foundation, which funded the fellowship. You still had to apply for it, right? So I'm grateful that they saw the work that I'm doing and this incredible program that I'm going to be able to deliver across this whole big state of Texas now called Praise Song for the People. It's a poetry project that is statewide. I'm going to commission 70 poets to write praise poems celebrating everyday Texans. So I wanted the poets in this incredible state to use the power of poetry to acknowledge the people who make this place great. We get caught up, I think, in the sound bites, right? Especially in this very heated political year. And I've had people ask me, you know, how can you live in Texas?
Yeah. So tired of hearing
that. And I mean, if that's the question we're asking, then how do you live on Earth?
Right.
Ooh,
thank you.
Because there's challenges and horrors, quite frankly, happening everywhere in real time right now.
That's right.
What makes any life livable first is the connection that we have with others.
Mm.
We can feel so alone, but we're not if we pay attention, right? And so I want to use the power of poetry to give people their flowers who are doing that good work of making this a beautiful place through community.
That's remarkable.
Another quote.
Yes, exactly.
So, Amanda, have you always written poetry? Have you always seen yourself as a poet?
Okay, so No. I'm not one of those that say I've been writing since I was a wee child. No, not really. But my mother always gave me poetry. Mm-hmm. Poetry is how we learn language. Mm-hmm. And I talk about this often, you know, through the golden nursery rhyme books, songs, right? It's poetry. Mm-hmm. And that's how we as infants learn how to communicate in any language. It's always comes back to poetry and song, how we're able to first speak and understand the world around us. But then something happens that we get taken away from that. So I give my mother so much credit for making sure I had poetry. She filled my room with books and poetry, and specifically Shel Silverstein.
Oh, Where the Sidewalk Ends.
Oh, ooh. Yeah. My first book of Shel was A Light in the Attic.
Light in the Attic, yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, so that was my question next. Who do you remember from your youth? So you were into Shel Silverstein,
oh,
too.
Yeah. No, big time Shel Silverstein. Because also with Shel, now in this good age, I can look back and the craft in his poetry, right? The mechanics are masterful.
Yes.
What he does with form, mm-hmm. and rhyme scheme. But then also for children's poetry, he was a bit daring.
Yeah,
you know?
Definitely was.
I was like, oh, no. You know, I was like 6 years old reading this stuff. Out? I'm like, what is this? What is he talking about?
We'll get to that.
Yeah. But I was just so fascinated by him. And so it intrigued me to read more.
Yeah.
Right. And then later, when I did start writing poetry, whether I knew it or not, it had already given me a foundation to be able to take a risk.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. I just recently found out he was a lyricist, too. He wrote, I don't remember songs. He's written songs we know.
Mm-hmm.
So to your point about the form he used, and the same thing, I remember reading those books as a just thinking they were funny, but you're right, they're so well structured and fascinating. And so when I think about sort of your emergence as a poet, you've kind of already mentioned Frank Walker and Crystal Wilkinson, but who are your role models in the poetry world, people you gravitated towards?
Lucille Clifton all day.
Ooh, yes.
Lucille Clifton's poem specifically, Won't You Celebrate With Me, that's the bar that I hold myself to, that if I'm doing my work correctly as a poet and I can get to a fraction of the power she has in that piece, then I've done my job.
Yeah.
Right?
I love that poem.
So yeah, Lucille Clifton always first. Toy Derricotte. More people should know about Toy Derricotte.
Absolutely. She's amazing.
And her work. Yes. She's also one of the founders along with Cornelius Eady of Cave Canem, which made a huge impact on my life. Not just my poetry, but my life. And then Sharon Olds. Sharon Olds is a phenomenal poet. Whenever I feel like I'm hiding from myself or not quite writing the truth that needs to be shared, I read Sharon Olds.
Mm.
Amazing.
How was it to meet and be in conversation at the Austin African American Book Festival with Nikki Giovanni?
Oh my gosh. Ooh. Nikki Giovanni, that's another one, right? Like, she's been a part of my poetry guide forever. And Nikki Giovanni, she just has lived such a rich, incredible life that it was obviously an honor to be in conversation with her as part of the African American Book Festival here in Austin. But then just to hear her talk about her unique and incredible life in a way that, you know, you think you're watching a movie, like you're listening to someone talk about a movie. She's like, and so when my book came out, we invited Nina Simone and she came, and we invited Morgan Freeman and he came, talking about when she released her self-published book when she was 24 in Harlem. It's like, where, you know, I was going to say, where's the documentary? But there is a documentary.
Yeah, exactly.
And if you haven't seen it, do see it. It's amazing. But yeah, we get to be in conversation just through the work, whether or not you're, you know, I'm as lucky as I was to be sitting across from her on a stage, but just to be able to read her work and be in the same time that she is in other icons is humbling. And I'm grateful. I'm so grateful.
Well, she is indeed a phenomenal woman.
Mm-hmm. Hey, shout out to Maya Angelou.
Yes.
Another one. Yeah, we keep saying these incredible icons, right?
Yeah.
We stand on their shoulders. I stand on their shoulders. No one who is doing this work now can do so and ignore Gwendolyn Brooks.
Yeah.
You know, these incredible women and knowing what hardships they faced.
Right.
to be able to share their work and build a life of letters and words for us to be here today with all of our joys and challenges now is a privilege and an honor.
I think it's awesome that, you know, you're so accomplished and you're so grounded and humbled by the folks that inspired you. So it's great to hear that. I bet you a lot of people listening do not know or did not know until now that Texas has a state poet laureate.
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned the Praise Song for the People project you're going to work on, but what are your responsibilities in the role, and how do you become the Texas Poet Laureate? Is there an election or?
Well, it's actually facilitated by the Texas Commission on the Arts. So they do the work of processing nominations and putting a committee together of other exceptional poets from across the state. And then they narrow that down to 10 finalists, and then they make a recommendation that actually goes to the legislature. And there's a committee in the House that signs off on, yes. So I have a resolution at home with the government seal on it and everything.
Amazing.
And you're still my faith in government now.
Truly, as long as the arts are acknowledged and held up, then that keeps me in a place of hope, right?
Yeah.
It keeps me hopeful. But they have, it's actually called the State Artists. So the Poet Laureate is one of four state artists. So they have a Poet Laureate, then they have a musical artist, and then a 2D and a 3D visual artist. Wow. So
are you ever asked to do a poem for special occasions?
Or? I would love to, but not. It has not happened officially, like from the government per se, but there is an incredible event coming up on the 7th to mark the launch of the Austin Poet Laureate Project. And that'll be at the Central Branch Library on September 7th. But KB Brookins, incredible poet, memoirist. Yeah. KB's doing all the things.
Nice.
And they worked really hard over the last 2 years for Austin to get a poet laureate. So we don't have the laureate named yet, but the program is starting. So they'll start the committee and search and all of that. So I'll be reading poetry there definitely to celebrate. But there really are no requirements of the state artists or the poet laureate, but one would not waste this opportunity, I imagine, at least not me. So I want to do something that's impactful, which is where the grant from the Academy really makes a difference.
That's fantastic.
I mean, the Praise Song for the People project sounds like a great contribution. So that's going to be fascinating.
Yeah. So, and after the 70 poets share their praise poems, there'll be readings in each of Texas's 7 regions. So we'll be going down to Rio Grande Valley.
Yeah.
We'll be going up to Abilene.
That's fantastic.
El Paso, Houston, Nacogdoches. And then in the spring, there'll be lesson plans and information for all K-12 schools.
Oh, that's great.
Because so often the Dallas and Houston and Austin get all the attention. So it's nice that that's going to be distributed throughout the state.
Yeah, we're going on the road. Texas is a big state, so I
sure
just figure out, okay, how can we make this happen?
Yeah.
So it's 7 regions.
7 regions of Texas. Most people don't know that you can drive for 24 hours from the most southern tip to the most northern tip.
And you're crying the entire time?
Absolutely.
Still in Texas.
Yeah, I come from one of those states like that. You can drive for hours. Still here.
Oh, yes, in California.
Yeah,
yep.
Still here.
Well, absolutely no pressure at all, and I don't know how, I hope that this is something is okay to ask, but can you read us some poetry or tell us some poetry?
I had a feeling you might ask.
She's ready.
A poet should be ready with poems. That is like
freestyle
a minimum.
For us? No.
Let's see here. How about...
We are very fortunate today.
Yeah, we're at a personal poetry reading with all our listeners.
I'm going to read this poem titled On the Other Side for the children of Gardner Betts. From my window, I see the children's prison. Juvenile detention sounds softer than it is. A younger version of me, pregnant and full of fire, sat in that box, weighing my future and the unnatural order of things. What a waste. One teacher shook her head upon my withdrawal. Just another insert stereotype. If only her mother, if only her father. History repeats itself again. My daughter churning inside my womb. 30 years later, on the other side of the street, I watch from the opulent hotel as little futures are pushed down the pipeline of forgotten children. I lean closer into my reflected eye, see the gritty residue of the past speckled across my face.
That's stunning. And I see what you mean about making sure that you do work that is honest and vulnerable, because that's where the truth and the art is. Thank you so much.
That's how we can see each other.
Yes.
And it takes a lot of work to get to a point when you know if you're doing it or not, right? So that poem comes. Also, I'll say I'm the I. If you've ever taken a poetry class, they'll tell you to assume the subject in the poem is the author, which is true. But for me, I'm the I. So if I'm writing about anything, the I is me. It's personal. It's informed, inspired from my lived experience. And even if it's a persona poem, say, about someone else, it's still coming through me. So there's still going to be a hint of my I. But that poem comes from my experience when I was pregnant. At 16, I had my oldest daughter when I was 17. And for a bit, I had to go to Gardner Betts for truancy. Imagine that, a teenager who was pregnant was missing school.
Yes, right.
Right.
And it was a very horrifying moment where my mother was threatened with, you know, a single mom, barely able to pay the bills, being fined, receiving a ticket, which she couldn't have paid. So that would have led to jail time and myself having to go to juvenile detention. But it worked. It worked itself out. And other than for a short stint, I had to go there. But I was there recently with my, not there, but across the street in a beautiful hotel as part of a writing retreat. And I looked across the street and realized where I was.
That's where you were. Yeah.
Wow.
30 years ago, I made it to the other side of the street.
Oh, that's beautiful.
The moral of the story is don't give up. Keep going.
Yeah.
Keep going.
And I was thinking about, too, about who is in there now.
Exactly.
We should go see them.
Exactly. I would love to.
Go do a reading over there.
I would love to go and visit them.
Yeah.
And I think that's resonance for us who grew up in Austin, because most of us know Gardner Betts.
Yes.
Either we know people who went there, or we had a gun there ourselves. So I think hearing you sort of, I love that you read the poem, and I love that you contextualized it and told us how it came about, because like you said, it's you. It's your story.
And also a lot of people are intimidated. Let's be honest too. A lot of our listeners may be intimidated by poetry and feel that often it's a kind of literature that's gated, and you know, and the kind of work that you're doing is, I would say, arms wide open.
Yeah.
As it should be. Poetry is for the people. Poetry has always been for the people. And if you go back and look through, you know, history, that's our griot. And you get outside of the United States, still contemporary poetry is celebrated. Yes. I was in Ireland, and everywhere I went, when they found out that I was a poet, people started reciting poetry, talking to me about their favorite poets, putting books in my hand, pulling them out of their bags and putting books in my hand. That doesn't happen the same way here in the United States. And I think that's intentional, and there's a long history why that is. So I am, my personal mission is to help restore poetry with the people.
Yes.
I just say, just knowing you for literally minutes, I think you have a warmth and a sort of welcoming about you that sounds very accessible. And what Lisa said, I totally agree with, like, do I snap my fingers now? That kind of thing. You just flow, and I was like, wow, that's great. And I love the fact that you can give us a story about the piece, right? So we know something about you through the poetry.
It's magnificent. I was recently visiting my in-laws in New York, and my mother-in-law, who is 75 years old, we were talking about poetry, as one does, and the excitement around the fellowship. She started reciting a poem from memory from grade school, from when she was in Jamaica.
Oh, wow.
And I was just in awe to see that come from the recesses of her mind 70 years later, how powerful poetry is.
Yeah.
and how natural it is. It's part of our natural rhythm as human beings, that cadence. And if you feel your pulse, that's iambic pentameter.
What? I had no idea.
Ba-bump, 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 ba-bump. That is yes. Iambic pentameter.
Wow. It's organic.
Mm-hmm.
So Black feminist poet Audre Lorde famously said, poetry is not a luxury. Mm. I love that essay. But lately I feel like poetry is a luxury. And so in what ways do you feel that poetry is luxurious? What is the power of poetry? Because it's like, I was going to think about playing with that idea of like, the way she means luxury, but also there's a way in which on the hearing people talk and recite poetry and being at poetry readings, it feels like your soul's being cuddled in.
It's yes, yeah. And it's yes, and it's not a luxury because your freedom is at stake. It is a luxury because it is freeing, right? So it's yes, and for me, that through all art, James Baldwin said that, you know, poets. And by which I mean all artists finally are the ones who know the truth about us, right? What he's saying in that moment is talking about freedom, right? So I feel most decadent when I'm able to do and create exactly what I want, right? Whatever that is, it's the freedom of it. So, no, I love being, and I'll say this too, all of the people talk about, you know, how you're going to be a poet and pay your bills. All of the most nice and luxurious and extravagant things that I've experienced in my life have been through poetry.
Mm. There you go.
Come on. That's beautiful.
And that's because I have done this work and found a space to be so free, right, in sharing my work, my voice, my poetry, that opens up room for me to get closer to what that thing is for me, right? What that big, hairy, crazy dream is. I mean, like, that's the thing that I want. But then when you're clear and you're focused on it and you're making your art and being truthful to that, then you can't help but continue on that path, right? But yes, I have had some incredible experiences because I've gotten closer to my art.
Luxury.
Yes.
Yeah, so since we're talking about quotes about poetry, you said a quote, which you kind of alluded to earlier, poetry is the heartbeat of language, it's the blood rhythm of our humanity, which is a fantastic quote. So as a professional poet, how do you encourage, I always think about young people listening to our podcast, how would you encourage somebody who is thinking like, I might be a poet, or I'm interested in poet, or I like poetry, how do you get them to start that process of writing and engaging in poetry?
Do it. You have to do it. You're not going to be where you want to be when you start, but no one is when they start. Start. That's it. I had to write a lot of wild, weird, bad drafts to get to the few good ones, right? Like, this one is ready to share. This one I feel strong about. You have to figure yourself out. And the only way to do that is by doing. We're watching and celebrating the Olympics right now, right?
Sure.
And we, you know, are watching these incredible athletes who have trained their life for seconds.
Yes.
Yeah.
For seconds, right? So you want to be a poet? Read lots of poetry.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be a poet? Start writing poems.
Yes.
Don't censor yourself to be, oh, well, I don't know the form. That's okay. You could make it up.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Doesn't matter.
Free verse.
Put words on a page. And then after doing that over and over and over again, something really incredible happens where the words start speaking back to you. And you start to see, it's like the Matrix. Like, you start seeing the ones and zeros behind the screen. It's like, oh, wait, these words want me to move this way. And now it looks like a sonnet. These words want me to move this way. And maybe this is a ballad. Maybe this is a sestina. Maybe this is something brand new. I created a form called the Genesis. Right?
Yes.
That's one of the most freeing things I could ever do. And the hardest things I've ever done is to create an entirely new form.
Mm.
But whenever people find out about my form and they try it for themselves and they say, you know, I didn't know you could make a form. Mm-hmm. Someone made the haiku.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right? You're reading Basho and you're reading these ancient Japanese haiku. That was created.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You can create anything. Just do it. Just start and fall in love with it. Mm-hmm. Fall in love with it.
Now, I think this is probably an obvious question to ask, but does it matter when you start writing?
No. That's one of the great things, too. It doesn't matter when you start writing or what your occupation is at the time you start writing. If you have a desire to express yourself, be it through poetry or fiction or, you know, any genre, you can write and still be that other thing. Matter of fact, that life you're living is going to inspire your writing in a unique way that will be purely yours, because it's not coming from any other vessel than yours. One of the greatest compliments I ever got from a poet I admire was that I'm living the life of a great poet. Mm. You, which just means I be out in these streets.
Right.
Living. just living. Just live your life. But that's an incredible thing. Richard Blanco, who was the inaugural poet for Obama's second term, incredible poet and trained engineer by mm-hmm. trade. Mm. But I'm sure that just informed his way of thinking, how he looks at the world, and then also being a queer Cuban American, right? Like all of that adds to his poetry. So you can be doing anything, but if you want to write, start writing.
Well, you know, you said something that I think about when I talk to my students. I do the same thing, which is to be a better writer, be a better reader, right?
Yes.
Read more, immerse yourself, and then, you know, I don't think of myself as a poet, but I feel it's kind of the same process.
Absolutely. No, if you're going to write, and I did say that you have to read. Right. You have to read, 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 and read more, because what that's going to do is some people will say that they don't like to read that much because they're scared it will, you know, bleed into their work. But the reality is we're inspired by everything.
Right. It's supposed to do that.
You're supposed to do that. And then you figure out what you like, what you don't like, exactly. What your preferences are. You get permission, right? Mm-hmm. Yes. When you're like, oh, wait, you could write a poem that speaks to subjects like this. Well, that now makes me think of something that happened in my life. I can write about that, right? You only know that until you're reading and discover that in other writers. So you should read a lot and then just take from it the inspiration that will then be filtered through your own personal experience.
I'm thinking that we're in a challenging age when it comes to reading, though. We're in a ferocious battle right now around book banning that has endangered the free and unfettered access to literature. And as an educator and a writer and a voracious reader myself, it gives me great concern. So this book banning movement, it's even made librarians, booksellers' lives very difficult and sometimes even dangerous. So how have book banning efforts impacted your work as a writer and as a publisher? Do you see any light at the end of the tunnel with this issue which we're faced with right now?
Oh my gosh, the light at the end of the tunnel is the pushback, right? For everyone who said, you know, people don't read or reading is dead, you know, why does it matter? The pushback mm-hmm. is what's showing you and telling you, know, we care about literature. Mm-hmm. We care about this ancient tradition of storytelling
yes.
and making it available for generations to come. You see that in, you know, the lawsuits that are happening. Praise the good folks over at Book People.
Yes,
books.
Shout out.
Yes, shout out to Book People.
Independent bookseller.
The largest independent bookstore in Texas, right here in Austin. They, along with another bookseller, won their case that was pushing back against a proposed bill here in Texas to make them like grade books, like
insane.
Yeah, which is incredible. Librarians on the front line, mm-hmm. making sure that books are available and accessible to students, yes. Families, parents yeah. who are showing up
yes.
at school board meetings and at their schools and saying, no, I want my child to be able to read and learn and explore. And if they have questions about what they read, let's talk to them. Let's have right. conversations. Yeah. Yes. This is how you learn, right? That gives me hope more than anything. And, you know, sadly, this isn't new in yeah. history, right?
Yep.
we know that this is a textbook fascist nationalist practice, right?
Absolutely.
And if anything, it keeps me hopeful and proud of the power of words. Why else would you be so afraid of someone reading and sharing their story?
Absolutely.
So to keep doing that. But that's also why, like, for me personally, as much stuff as I publish and share, which admittedly is not as much as other as my contemporaries, I want to make so much of it free and accessible. So you can find a lot of my work online
that's
for
true.
Free.
Yes, right.
Yeah. Thank you for that. It's so generous. Besides being an award-winning poet, you are also a leader in many poetry organizations and movements. The Kavikanam Foundation, the Black Poets Speak Out, and as founder and executive director of Torch Literary Arts. 18 years ago, you founded a nonprofit that supports other Black women writers. So please talk to us about why you created Torch Literary Arts.
Oh, thank you so much for that. And thank you, Lisa, for being featured in Torch. That means so much that we had you in Torch Magazine online.
Thank you.
With your incredible 10-minute play. That's exactly why I did it. I wanted there to be a space reserved for us. Mm. You know, as a Black woman writer, and this was in 2006 when I started. So a lot of these accomplishments came well after starting it. But at the time... again, speaking about having different professions, I did freelance web design.
Wow.
So I said, I don't have to ask anyone to do this, and I don't have to pay anyone to do this. I can just do this. So I did. And I was fortunate to have an incredible community of other poets and writers as friends who submitted work so that we could feature their work and celebrate them. And we continued doing that online and then added our Wildfire Reading Series to bring people together in independent bookstores to host readings, celebrating these incredible emerging and experienced Black women writers. But being unapologetic and unwavering that it centers Black women's voices. And the reason for that was just even in creative communities, I was seeing and have felt where I was often doing the labor.
Right.
To make.
Oh, yes.
Right. So Black women are often called upon to do the work, but then not get the reward or even just beyond reward, rest, support.
Yep.
So I said, well, if we can do this for other people, surely we can do it for ourselves.
Woo.
So that's what Torch is. As me, as a Black woman writer, my gift to other Black women writers, that this is a space reserved for us. But then globally, we reap the benefits of that incredible writing, right? It's not just for Black women to read. It's for everyone to read and enjoy, free online. But I was thinking about that this morning and just seeing so many different quotes and things that we always turn to by incredible icons of the literary world, incredible Black women like Toni Morrison,
yes.
Nikki Giovanni, Maya Angelou, you know, the list goes on. And the first thing I thought in my mind was, don't just quote us, compensate us.
Yeah.
Like, support us
yeah,
with more than a round of applause and a retweet.
Yeah, and a hashtag.
And a hashtag.
A finger snap.
Yeah, show up. So, you know, that's why in 2000, 2022, we relaunched. Yes, just 2 years ago, we relaunched Torch. We got our nonprofit status, and so we could actually go after major funding. So now every feature, whether it's in our online magazine, our reading series, our retreat that we launched last year, is provided at no cost to fellows to come for a week and write. Everyone is paid and compensated for their work, because that matters too.
You showcase their work.
And we showcase their work. And we do that globally. We publish folks from around the world, from, Jamaica, Germany, South Africa, Nigeria, Canada. One of our fellows this summer was from Nigeria. So
nice.
Making the global literary community of incredible Black women writers more accessible even to us to see each other. There's great power in that, and joy, always centering in joy.
Yeah, you know, as you're talking, I wish folks could see, your eyes light up. You know, this is truly a labor of love for you. So, mm-hmm. you know, talk about the most rewarding part of building, you know, the Torch Literary Arts and Torch Magazine in Austin. What have you learned about how the arts are valued in the U.S. and the world and in Texas?
Well, it was really special to create this here in Austin. I had been traveling around that time in 2006, and a friend asked me why I was always leaving and when I was going to have more events here. And I told her the honest answer. I said, the invitations don't come from here. So I go where I'm invited.
Right.
And that's really what made me think, well, why can't it be here? I live here. So many incredible writers and creators live here. Austin is, you know, this progressive arts. Exactly. That's what the bumper sticker says. Ooh. So why not have it here? So that for me was a real honor and a challenge to make it here. But I wanted to have this in my home where I lived. We deserve this. We deserve more spaces for us here where we call home. So that's why I did that here. And it's grown. And in that time now, seeing from 2000, just from 2006 to 2024, we see so many other incredible arts organizations here in Austin, right? That are intentionally for Black and BIPOC communities. So, you know, and then the city showing up and funding. One of our major funders for Torch Literary Arts is the city of Austin. So thank you for that. We appreciate that. And we need more of that.
Yes.
But yeah, that's being here in Austin and all the changes that we know here, you know, as Austin's continue to grow, gentrification is real. Like I said, I had family over. I would go to my papa's house on MLK and it looks nothing like it did, you know, growing up. Yeah. So that also for me means that we have a responsibility to, you know, not just preserve what's left here, but return. What does a right to return look like for people that help make this place what it is? And how do you retain and attract, right? Yeah. And for me, that means you have yes and. It's not a one size fits all. Black people are not a monolith. Mm-mm. We like all kinds of different creative things, social things. And yes, literature. Fun fact, number one person most likely to read a book is a Black woman.
Yes.
And that came out from a Pew report.
Yes.
Yeah.
That came evident in the 80s when when we were just changing the whole landscape with Alice Walker and Toni Morrison.
As most educated, and most likely to read a book. So why not have a place for Black women writers to thrive in Austin? Sounds like an ideal place to have it.
And who are you reading right now, speaking of reading?
Oh my gosh, there's so many good books that are out. It's really hard to narrow it down because I'm going to read to not say someone.
Yeah.
But I'll say one of the first things I'm reading are the submissions to Torch.
Fantastic.
Myself and our associate editor, shout out Jay Nichelle, we read each and every submission that comes in. And it truly is emerging and very experienced writers who are sending us their work. So it's an honor to read their work. And we're reading across genres. So poetry, fiction, now creative nonfiction. We actually publish. So personal essays, excerpts from memoir, and then, you know, Lisa, scripts.
Because we're a little ball headed stepchildren.
No, absolutely.
Even the Hurston Wright Awards doesn't include theater.
Yeah, no, we do. We look at we just say script to hold space for plays, screenplays, and then we also know Black women are the trendsetters. So if there's something that is dialogue based that you might feel is not, you know, aligned with the traditional format, send it to Torch. Black women, send us that work because I want to see how you're innovating and pushing literature. Right?
I love it.
It's the call.
Yeah.
So tell me how you read. Are you the kind of person, like, because I have I can't read more than one thing at a time because I get lost. Do you read like five books at once or do you try to go through them sequentially? How do you?
I read several things at once inconsistently.
Okay, so what I bad.
Yeah, no, so that's one thing, reason why I think poetry spoke to me. Mm-hmm. And I use it, you know, to get folks hooked. Like, you can read one poem.
Yes.
You can read, you got time, you can read one poem, and then that's going to get you hooked and to keep reading more stuff. So I always have a stack of books that, you know, on a weekend, I'll read a couple pages of each, and then I might not come back to them until the next week. But constantly having books around me to engage my brain and to go somewhere else and get lost in a story or poem, always at hand. What do I have right now? KB's memoir, Pretty, okay, is there on my in my stack. I also have, I always have Lucille Clifton, so her collected is always near me. It's like spiritual, like a Bible at this point. I'm reading Andrea Vocab's latest book, She Walks in Music. She, Andrea Vocab, former poet laureate of San Antonio. Also reading memoir by Deborah D. Mouton, former poet laureate of Houston. Mm-hmm. So incredible Black women writing and leading in these literary spaces around Texas. I could go on, but that's good. Read Texas authors too. Read Texas writers.
You give a whole list of folks for people to check out.
So talk to us a little bit about your move into visual arts. You recently had a solo show at the Museum of Human Achievement entitled Boxes, A Work in Progress. How was that experience, creating an entirely different discipline and making it, being public with it, sharing it with the public?
Again, freeing. It's so freeing. That's the mantra, is get free. And the lockdown portion of COVID and the pandemic, I won't say it's over because it's not. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when we all went into lockdown in 2020, time became very real and urgent. And for me, having that time to be at home, not able to distract myself with a lot of the things that we typically do, work, family responsibility, whatever, this here in this house, in this room, the images that come to me that inspire my art across the page, right, in poetry and writing, were coming in a very urgent and tangible way that they could not be translated into text. So I had to use my hands. Paired with that was the desire to create in that way. And the reality of, if I don't do it now, when will I? I don't know. During the lockdown, we saw what was happening. We were losing people every day, every minute. So I said, if this is something I want to do, then I'm going to do it and I'm going to have fun doing it.
Yeah.
So I started creating these mixed media pieces, sculptures based with the balaclava ski mask. Underneath, and just first the joy, like I said, of playing. Once I started playing with the fabric and the materials, and it felt like jazz, like riffing. I had an idea of what I wanted this to look like, but then I started working the material, and I was like, oh wait, what if I did this and what if I did that? And then putting them on and photographing myself in them. That was the first show I did in 2023. Was actually at Prizer Arts and Letters. And then this latest show this year at Museum of Human Achievement was just a continuation of that, right? And I don't want to over prescribe what it is, right? And just do the work, like make the work and go through that process. But Boxes, A Work in Progress, was me playing with a different way, a different form. I made these boxes wrapped in newspaper, which was really interesting because I didn't know what was going to be printed in the news. So there was no way for me to plan that.
Right.
And I just kept wrapping these boxes. It was over 40 boxes. Then I adhered to the wall and then had a smaller box with little trinkets inside or not, or empty. And then seeing what people then projected and gleaned and pulled from the combination of that was fascinating. In the center were the balaclavas, and people would come through, and I'd be making as they were coming through and adding to them and just building and building on top of it. So it was just an incredible practice of, one, being free and creating and acting on an artistic impulse, mm-hmm. and being present and saying, I don't know exactly how this is going to end, but let's see what happens together.
You know, that just format is just interesting to me. So when you were in the creating process and people were sort of milling around, did you work sort of independently? Did people come to talk to you or interact with you? Or?
Oh, yeah. No, I would talk to people. It wasn't like, it wasn't performance art where people were like, you know, she's part of the show. Yeah. But I was. There was a light like on me while I was sitting there making. I was making these chains out of yarn. It's this four-finger weave technique that I learned in elementary school.
Oh, okay.
And it just stayed with me, and I liked making them. Mm. And you can make them really quickly. So it's just a little simple weave technique. So I was sitting in the chair just making them, and it was always funny when people would come in and see me, and they would get quiet.
The artist is working.
Walk around, and I would say, hi. And how are you doing? I'm so glad you came. So I was interacting with everybody. Yeah, a great artist. Chris Abani is a fantastic poet, and
he wrote poetry too.
Chris Abani, oh yes.
I know him as a novelist. Okay.
Oh yes, yes, incredible poet. Read "Smoking the Bible."
Okay.
Something else, but he said that he was, talking about the practice, right, of writing, and I would say that for all art, you know, take the work seriously, but don't take yourself too seriously.
This goes back to, again, to what I noticed about you, which is this idea of bringing people into the work. So yeah, I think most people would walk by and say, oh, like you said, let her, mm-hmm. but getting people to be engaged in some way. One of the first things we talked about when I got to know you was that you're a mom, and mm-hmm. you've got two grown daughters, got a grandchild.
Yes.
What are your thoughts about raising a Black family during these times? Mm. Challenges? What's optimistic about this period?
You know, that's something that has really been beautiful. I mean, I love my family, and seeing them blossom and have opportunities that, you know, my husband and I didn't have, let alone our parents, mm-hmm. you know, you go back, right? And so you can see the progress in that way, but still knowing there's so much to come. It was also one of the most fearful times in my life, which still, you know, you never stop being a mom. They don't tell you that part. Uh-oh. It's like, they're 18 and then they're gone. No, you are a mom forever. And so having this relationship now with my daughters in a different way, mm-hmm. as adults, as women, right, is interesting. And I'm so incredibly proud of them, and I stay fearful knowing the world that we're in, mm-hmm. right? That was one of the reasons why I did. I was a co-founder of Black Poets Speak Out. Myself and other poets came together to create this poetic demonstration against the police killings that were happening. And we were seeing not just people who could be our family, members of our community, there was their family.
Yeah.
Right? We were finding out how many Black poets were related to people who had been killed or harmed or hurt by police. And when Mike Brown was murdered in Ferguson, and me being from East St. Louis, my dad had lived in or near Ferguson for a while. In my life, so it made it very real, very close to home, and I wanted to do something immediately, thinking that this is my family, these are my people, this is mm-hmm. what are we going to do, what can we do? And being a poet, I turned to poetry. I say if I was a doctor, I would have turned to other physicians, I would have done something else to rally my community. Yeah. So the Black Poets Speak Out called on poets, Black poets, to share poems that spoke to freedom, justice, and against police brutality. and called on allies to share work by Black poets so that they weren't centering their voices and their names, but are amplifying the call from Black writers in our community to speak out against police violence. So for me, just that fear has never been a held place in me that has made me still or incapacitated. Mm-hmm. It's always been a switch to turn me on to do something, to say move forward. My mama was a union steward too. So wow, I was raised with the phone company. I was raised in a union household, Communication Workers of America, shout out. So I wasn't raised to be a bystander.
Yes.
It was, if something's wrong, you got to do it. And my mom always would tell me, once you learn something, you can't unlearn it.
Yeah.
And so when I would see injustice, or so, okay, so what are we going to do? Mm-hmm. What can we do? Let's get busy. My daughters have taken that on in different ways, and I love to see them pushing the envelope and being free in new and beautiful ways. And my grandbaby, oh gosh, don't get me started. I am that Nana. I will go on. If I could show you a picture on the radio, Nana. I would figure it out to show you through the airwaves. But he is fantastic. And again, just continuing to add more and more and more until we do get to true freedom.
Mm.
Well, it's Nina Simone, no fear.
Yes.
When there's no fear, then we're free.
I'm thinking about this idea of freedom. One of our favorite things to do is ask a signature question to our guests, which is, where do you feel most authentically Black in Austin?
Where do I feel most authentically Black in Austin? In my skin. Wherever I'm at, that's where I'm in. Mm. I mean, truly. For me, you know, and it's different having been raised here, right? Yeah. There was a sister who came to a torch event who said something that stuck with me. She said, you know, if you're not from here, Black people have a shelf life in Austin. And I said, ooh. And then I started thinking about all of the incredible artists and educators and folks who come through Austin, were here for 2 to 6 years and then left. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what she's saying is true, you know? So we have to do better about making what we feel, those of us who are from here and live here, inviting and welcoming to other folks, right? Because me being here, truly, I mean, this is where I'm from, my family. I go anywhere in Austin, I can remember when I was a kid with my family there, right? But yeah, how you bring, was that June Jordan, how you bring your whole self into the room, yes. Right?
Yes.
I feel that I can do that. I don't always feel that that's welcome, but that doesn't change how I do it.
Yes.
Right? But for our community, you know, we have to make that more, that feeling, that welcoming space more accessible to more, whether you from here or not.
I love that. Thank you. I'm in my 12th year, 13.
Yeah, you can claim it now.
I mean, you live here. What are the places?
I live here. I work here. I raise my child here.
Yes.
You got bona fides.
But I got to rep the Bay.
And with so much has changed here too. It's so many landmarks. So many spaces don't look how they used to look. Places aren't what they used to be. But no, for me, it's community. And when I show up, any place where I go, I want everyone who looks like me from my community, Black people I'm speaking about specifically, I want you to feel that you can and show up and be there with me. Mm. You know, that's when I feel the most. Not just free, but loved. Mm. I don't have to know you. Well, I can look up and see you. I know we're we. Mm. Yeah. Right?
We're so fortunate you showed up here for us. Absolutely. To come to talk to us at Black Austin Matters. Thank you so much for being our guest.
Thank you, Amanda.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for doing this good work. Black Austin Matters, for sure.
Black Austin Matters is a listener-supported production of KUT and KUTX Studios in Austin, Texas.
You can support our work by becoming a sustaining member at supportthispodcast.org. Black Austin Matters is a production of KUT and KUTX Studios.
It's hosted by me, Richard J. Reddick, and
me, Lisa B. Thompson. Black Austin Matters is produced and edited by our amazing executive producer, Miles Bloxon.
Sarah Kinney helped with research, editing, and production. The music you're listening to was created by the talented Jerron Marshall. For more about Black Austin Matters, visit KUT.org or wherever you get your podcasts.